Okay, so moving along, item three on the agenda is the planning.
Excuse me, Chair, we have to elect a vice chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're right. A vice chair. Are there nominations? Who would normally? I thought there was some rotational scheme.
It's done on a rotation, and if you care to continue the rotation as we have in the past, the vice chair this year would be Commissioner Garcia.
Move that.
Second.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Then all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Abstain.
Okay, so that carries on a 3-0, one absent and one abstention. Congratulations.
Thank you. Likewise.
My condolences. Okay, so now moving along, item three is the planning director's report. I guess without the planning director present, we won't have a report unless staff is prepared to report on anything.
I have nothing to report.
Okay. So item four is the county council report.
I have nothing to report. Thank you.
Okay. Item five, additions and corrections to the agenda.
Yes, we do have three additions to the agenda, all of which you have received a copy of. The first is a revised page for the conditions of approval for item number 11. That's application 111114. And regarding item number 12, there are two letters to your commission, one from Betty Cost and one from Ron Powers of Powers Land Planning.
Okay, thank you for that. Item six is a report on upcoming meeting dates and agendas.
The next regularly scheduled meeting for your commission will be the 22nd of February. The first meeting was canceled because the Coastal Commission will be in the board chambers the first when it would normally have been scheduled. The only item that we will have on that agenda is hopefully the Aptos Village Plan. I know we've been promising that for a long time. Hopefully this time it'll stick.
Okay, thanks for that. The next item, seven on our agenda, is oral communications. This is the time allotted for any member of the public to speak to the commission on a matter that's not on the published agenda. So if you could just state your name for the record. And
my name is Marty DeMare, and I'm speaking about indirectly an item that's on your agenda having to do with the appeal, but my comments are not directly part of that appeal, so I just would like to offer them as sort of background.
Sure.
This project represents a use of the public Highway 1 right-of-way that to enable a commercial development, that is the placement of this fiber optic cable to serve these Verizon cell towers. This is kind of a different situation than the typical one that where the right-of-way is allowed to be used by the utilities such as phones and the PG&E, which were, as they are called, the incumbents. This is sort of a new situation here, and I think it's sort of fallen through a regulatory crack in that there are, for instance, Coastal Commission guidelines that say, yes, we want to exempt these sort of operations, but these guidelines pertaining to, of course, coastal zone installations, such as this one, were offered before the...
I'm sorry, the county council wants to step in.
It seems like this is close enough to your first item that if this gentleman wants to be included in the record on the first item, he might either have to repeat these comments again or he might be better off speaking about it because it seems generally pretty similar to the appeal involving the cell tower sites.
So do you have the ability? You have the ability to speak during the next item on the appeal.
Yes, I know. But
if your comment, I don't know if you intend to speak or not.
I don't think that my comments are really germane to the appeal, and I don't see why county council cares when I make my comments. That's okay. That wasn't my intention.
Okay, so you please proceed.
The Coastal Commission staff provided me with some guidelines to exemptions for coastal permitting, coastal commercial development permits. These guidelines were created in, I think, 78, which precedes the time when the companies such as NextG were created to offer other alternatives, shall we say, to the incumbent utilities. All to the point that now we're in a situation where not only does the upcoming application require some exceptions, but I think it would be time for staff to visit the possibility that these regulations need to be updated so that these exemptions aren't required, and at the same time perhaps consider whether the comments I just made about use of the public right-of-way, whether these sort of permits shouldn't include some kind of public benefit besides just a benefit to the one developer, that in this case is Verizon or NextG. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for those comments. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to the commission on a matter that's not on the agenda? Then seeing none, item 8 is a declaration of any ex parte communications, if any commissioners want to disclose anything regarding the two items that are on the agenda. Then seeing none, we'll move to the consent agenda, items 9 and 10. 9 is the approval of the minutes of our December 14th meeting, and item 10 is the annual report for calendar year 2011, the annual report of the Planning Commission.
Chair?
Mm-hmm.
I will be abstaining from the minutes of the previous meeting because I was not there, but I also wanted to note a correction in item number 10, the annual report.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a small thing, but I just thought I'd point it out that in the attendance roster for the meeting of December 14th, it's listed that there was no representation from the 3rd District, but Denise Holbert, my alternate, was here for that meeting. So I just wanted to point that out, that that's a mistake.
Okay. Yeah, I remember that, actually.
With that correction, I'd like to move the consent calendar.
Second.
Okay, so there's a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Then, seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. And that carries, well, I guess on item 9,
yeah,
3 to 0 with one absent and one abstention. And then item 10 is approved on a 4 to nothing vote with as changed. And that brings us to the scheduled items for today. We start with item 11, which is an appeal of a zoning administrator.
That is application 111114. There's no address for this. This is 7 sites in the Caltrans and County right-of-way and an equipment shelter on APN 058-02211. This is an appeal of the zoning administrator's approval of a proposal to install 7 new microcell wireless communication facilities, each to be co-located on existing utility poles along the inland side of Highway 1. 6 sites in the Caltrans right-of-way, 1 site in the county Swanton Road right-of-way. This proposal includes a 192-square-foot, 13-foot, 6-inch-tall equipment shelter on an agricultural parcel. It requires a Level 5 commercial development permit, a Level 5 coastal development permit, and 3 Telecommunication Act exceptions to requirements contained in the county wireless communication facilities ordinance. 6 of the proposed utility pole microcell sites are located in the Caltrans right-of-way along an approximately 13-mile stretch of Highway 1, beginning 3.8 miles northwest of Western Drive and ending 0.4 miles northwest of the entrance to Big Creek Lumber. The 7th site is located in the county right-of-way along Swanton Road on a utility pole approximately 1.1 miles north of the southernmost Swanton Road intersection with Highway 1. The equipment shelter is proposed to be located immediately northwest of the southernmost intersection of Highway 1 and Swanton Road. This was appealed on December 16, 1911 by Andrew and Juan Jean Sue. The owner is NextG Networks. The applicant is Natasha Ernst. It's in the 3rd Supervisorial District, and the project planner is Frank Barron. Frank?
Thanks, Kathy. Good morning, Planning Commissioners. As Kathy mentioned, this item is an appeal of the ZA's approval of a proposal to install 7 microcell sites along the north coast each proposed to be located upon existing utility poles in highway or roadway rights-of-way. Microcells are smaller versions of cell towers, where a relatively smaller set of antennas and equipment are attached to existing structures or poles, in this case, utility poles. The focus of the appeal was on one of the proposed microcell sites only, the site known as DAV-01, proposed to be located at the 3 Mile Beach turnout on Highway 1, approximately 3 miles north of the city of Santa Cruz city limits. However, denial of this application by your commission would invalidate the approval of all 7 of the proposed microcell sites, not just the one site that is in dispute. However, in the time since this appeal was filed, the applicant, NextGE Networks of California, has been working with the appellant, and a solution appears to have been worked out, rendering this appeal unnecessary. This solution would involve moving the objectionable microcell site, DAV-01, to a different location, approximately 1/4 mile to the south, adjacent to Dimio Lane, near its intersection with Highway 1. This proposed microcell at the new location would be submitted as a separate application by the applicant in the coming weeks. Under this scenario, the appellant is prepared to drop their appeal, and if your commission is amenable to this proposed solution, we have drafted a new set of conditions of approval that would allow construction of all the sites previously approved, except for DAV-01 at the 3 Mile Beach location. Therefore, staff recommends that your commission hear public testimony on this matter and approve application 111114, subject to the amended conditions. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Commissioner Arambrew.
Frank, as I understand it, then, in the sense of if we take this condition of approval and approve that, then the issue is moot and we go back to the approval of the project, is that correct? There's no other appeal of any other aspect of it?
Correct.
Thank you.
I guess I have a question then. What? So how would this DAV-1 site be approved? Is that now in the city of Santa Cruz? They have to approve it? Or what? How will that site get approved?
We have not seen the exact location, but my understanding it's along Dimio Lane in county right-of-way. So it would require an encroachment permit from the County Department of Public Works, and other than that, it would just be a separate, application that would come in, and we would process it as we normally do with most cell towers.
I guess I one other question, and it goes back to what the speaker mentioned during the oral communications, but could the county charge some sort of an annual fee or a lease fee or some sort of fee for use of county right of way for this type of a facility? And this could this be some sort of a potential revenue generator for the county?
What would be the basis of the fee? I mean, what would be the amount of the fee? Because I think there would have to be some relationship to how much the fee would be in terms of reasonable fee. And the other thing I would say is, Frank, I would let you comment on this as well, because I mean the case law on this particular issue has been changing quite a bit in the last couple of years.
Okay. There has been some 5 or more years ago, there had been a series of discussions about this, and a decision had been made to have the Department of Public Works issue a temporary encroachment permit that's renewable every 5 years. So that's my understanding. That is the system under which these microcells that are in county right-of-way only would be subject to renewal of the encroachment permit every 5 years. And the idea behind that was that if it to give the county time to determine whether charging of some sort of monthly rent or something like that for use of the right-of-way would be appropriate, looking at case law that has been more recent since then.
It's jogging my memory, which is that there's a really old provision in the Public Utilities Code from like the early 1900s relating to the telephone companies, and basically the current state of the law is that the wireless companies can't be treated any differently than the existing telephone companies are treated, who are allowed to use the right-of-way with very little in the way of charges or regulation, and that's what the government agencies, San Diego County, LA County, that's what people are trying to figure out, is where the wireless companies fit in to the overall use of the public right-of-way by the telephone wired telephone utilities. But I'd be happy to look at it more and let the commission know at our next meeting, or let you know personally what the current state of the law is. But it's a rapidly changing area of law. But in other words, the county couldn't charge these carriers something that they couldn't charge the regular carriers as well, and that's tricky to do since they've been out there for a very long period of time.
Okay, and then just one other question I had is, is there any provision in the approval of this where if these facilities became obsolete or were no longer, let's say technology evolves and these microcell facilities aren't needed, would they have to be removed?
Yes, there's a provision in the conditions of approval, and I'd have to look up the page number, but you have it in your packet.
Okay, I didn't see it, but
one of the conditions is that in that kind of scenario where technology renders these sites unnecessary, advances in technology, or if there has been some decision made to remove all utility poles along Highway 1, say, or underground those utilities, that these would indeed have to be removed.
Okay, thanks. So, although I understand the appeal has been withdrawn, I guess do we still need to conduct a public hearing since it was noticed?
Yes, I'd take comment from anyone, and I just looked in the code under the appeals provision, and one of your actions is to approve the permit with modifications, and that's what would be occurring here.
Okay. So this is a public hearing, a scheduled public hearing, so we will open the hearing, and if there's any member of the public that would like to speak on this, please step forward and give us your name. And
good morning, commissioners. My name is Natasha Ernst. I'm Director of Government Relations for NextG Networks. NextG Networks is a telephone corporation. We are not a wireless carrier. We have a certificate of public, CPCN, Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity from the California Public Utilities Commission. And we build infrastructure that is used by some of the commercial wireless carriers. Today, it's not a secret that this infrastructure will initially be used by Verizon. But what we do is, there's a backbone of fiber optic cable that allows this to be high-speed wireless broadband in addition to voice services through this area of the Highway 1 coastline where there currently is not a lot of service. I am an AT&T customer, so there is service at some microcell sites that are out there, which my mother likes very much because I like to go biking. And so on New Year's Day, I started in Natural Bridges, and I went up through Wilder Ranch, and she could call me, and she could get a hold of me. And my mother, every time she can get a hold of me, makes her happy. But for the folks out there who have other carriers, there isn't service along this line. And people have wanted to place different proposals, different types of infrastructure out in this area of the coast, and have not had success. So this is the Cadillac of how to provide these services. We use the existing pole line, put the fiber optic cable in, and then have a series of small wireless antennas, and at this point it went from 7 to 6, and there will be coverage in this part of the county greater than there is at this time. So if you have any questions for me, I'm happy to answer any of them.
Mr. Ernst, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Ernst.
You know, there's been a broad push, no pun intended, for broadband. It's talked about at the national levels. The city of San Francisco had, at one time, had plans to have broadband for every citizen. Do you see that momentum there in terms of your representations?
Yes, I do. And even last night in the State of the Union, President Obama addressed rural broadband specifically. And I go to the FCC a lot. There's a lot of different movements going on, particularly as it applies to the Universal Service Fund, to get broadband to rural communities. To my knowledge, and I know from my company that builds nationwide, I'm proud to be working on this project because it's rural broadband. And even though it will be wireless, it will increase through the different kind of services that you have. You can basically turn your house into a hotspot. Even if you don't have fiber to the home, it will provide great broadband speeds just by having a secondary device out there.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yes, Commissioner Dan.
I just had a question about the microcell that is not going to be installed. And we hear a lot from the North Coast residents up there, including some that spoke that will probably speak today, that you know, they've been clamoring for better cell coverage. So I think that this will probably help a lot. Could you tell me what removing that one cell, microcell, will do to the coverage in that area?
Yes. So part of the reason why we had a little bit of delay is because of the holidays. What we did is we had our radio frequency engineer who designs the network go out and visit this and look at the poles, because the poles go out DeMayo Lane. And so we selected a new pole that does not have any nearby residents. And there's also some trees that will kind of help screen the microcell from view. And then he did a test to confirm that it would cover the same area that would have been serviced by DAV-01. Now, that service will come on air a little later because we will be coming back through the application process. But the coverage will not be decreased in the long run, even though it will just be a little slower.
Well, I want to thank you for working with the community on this. I think it's really important, and you know, it's difficult because we have a beautiful North Coast that we want to protect, the public viewshed, while at the same time, you know, residents up there do want to have the cell coverage that the rest of us have.
Yes.
So I appreciate that you tried to work that out.
Yes, it's pretty much my favorite part of the state as well. It's very beautiful.
I just had a brief question. In addition to thanking you for your cooperation with the community, I was just wondering if there were any similar projects lined up for South Santa Cruz County in terms of...
We have been looking at something down in South Santa Cruz County, down in, I believe, the Watsonville area and further south. So, yes, we are evaluating that, as well as many people know that the cement plant, which covers the town of Davenport, is due to be torn down, and so we're also looking at providing coverage when that coverage area becomes a coverage gap.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other speakers on this matter? Yes.
Yes, Martin DeMere again. As Commissioner Aramburu noted, there is, of course, the hope and the push from federal and state to get more broadband out there. In my letter to the ZA, I pointed out that there were some topographical difficulties, shall we say, in connection with DAV-03, I think it is, which is the one nearest our Coast Road neighborhood. And I was asking the ZA to allow NextG, or I should say Verizon, to put a pole top antenna in place of the what they call the communication space antennas. It was my hope that that placement would enable better signal into our Coast Road neighborhood, which there's about a dozen homes and probably twice that many users. ZA did not see fit to give NextG that discretion, but I would like to ask perhaps this commission, in the interest of getting a hotspot kind of coverage that we crave, that they would allow some discretion to enable that sort of antenna to be used instead of the lower pole top, which just isn't going to quite cut it for all our neighborhood. And I think Ms. Ernst has acknowledged that in the past at the ZA hearing. One other item I wanted to bring up was there is a county code section which pertains to, I think, the is it DAV-07, the antenna on Swanton Road. There's no written comments, but a resident commented at the ZA. My question is how the how that placement of that pole complies with County Code Section 13.20.142, which is addresses Swanton Road area special design criteria, which basically says no commercial development visible from the county road or from Highway 1. And I don't recall that that was addressed in the staff report anywhere. Thank you, that's all.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
Can we ask the representative from NextG to address Marty's first question about the difference between the two antennas, and then if staff could also comment. It seems like in the visual simulations we have photos of both.
Yes. So when making a judgment about what is considered minimal visual impact, we had two designs. One is on the pole top, and then one was in the communication space. Staff and with someone from the Coastal Commission agreed that they preferred the communication space design. So what we have done, the same radio frequency engineer that has selected the alternate location for DAVO1 has selected a secondary location for DAVO3 that will provide the residents of Coast Road with the high-speed wireless broadband coverage in their houses, because right now, based on our projections, DAVO1 will provide them coverage, but not as good inside of their homes just because the buildings attenuate the signal. So again, there will be, we will be back again, working on that solution, because having that coverage for the community and for Marty, we talk regularly about this subject, is very important to us.
And what's the timeline on that?
Probably about the next 6 months, because everything is right now in the engineering process. So we're putting together the application package right now. Then it will come in. There's some process. There's some notice and some mock-ups. And then it takes about 6 months, 4 to 6 months.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So just so I understand, I'm a little confused. So DAVO3. That would be the one that would be serving the Coast Road neighborhood area, or that area?
Yes.
You're going to be coming back with an application for an additional facility there, or a replacement, or what?
Because of the way the county code is structured regarding these things, you look at alternates. So one of the alternates would be putting the antenna on the pole top, because that will meet the coverage. The other alternate would be a second location for another microcell on an existing utility pole.
Okay.
And I don't believe we're considered commercial development, because we are a telephone corporation, and so we fall into the public utility bunch. And so attaching to utility poles under 7901, Public Utilities Code 7901, is kind of our statewide franchise, and so that answers the second question about the Swanton Road area.
So do you ultimately own these, then? Is that how it works? You own the microcell sites, and then
yes.
You go to Verizon, for example, and work out some arrangement with them to make use of?
We are carriers, so we provide the wholesale services and the transport along the fiber optic cable. And that allows the high-speed backhaul that allows wireless services out in this area, which do not have a lot of infrastructure as is, but they do have utility poles. And then we are joint owner of the utility poles through the Northern California Joint Pole Association.
Okay.
More than you wanted to think about utility poles on a Wednesday morning, probably.
Commissioner Aramburu.
Is it possible for someone that has diminished signal in their home to have attenuators that amplify the signal? You know, there are some devices that are intended to boost your internet speed.
There are, and some of them work. Some of them are unlicensed, which the FCC actually has a docket open on that subject right now. So some of them work better than others. There are services where you can sometimes plug into your internet and then boost the signal that way, but those often come with additional monthly fees, and they only are as good as you have a broadband internet into your home already. So this would allow folks to basically turn their homes into hotspots without an additional utility payment, potentially.
Thank you.
So I just want to just get one last thing clarified just for the Coast Road folks. So currently with the program we have, the plan that we're moving forward with right now, won't offer them complete coverage inside their homes, but with the new application in process and the new location of the DV1, mm-hmm. That will satisfy that problem.
Yes. Okay. Full coverage is ultimately our goal, even if sometimes it comes in pieces.
Will you bundle those two together, or will they have to be separate applications for the Dimio Lane and the...
We had a lot of success bundling these together, and we're able to take the one that became an issue. So we'll work with staff, but yeah, conceivably it's easier to bundle.
Okay. So did, I don't know, staff want to respond to the second part of that, the speaker's comment about Section 1320-140, I guess Swanton Road, not Swanton Road. Swanton Road guidelines.
That section 1320-142 says that no development within the Swanton Road special scenic area shall be visible from in the viewshed of either Swanton Road or Highway 1. And Ms. Ernst mentioned, it's not this type of installation is not considered development. It's already on an existing pole. And if you care to take a look at the photo simulation on pages 134 through 136 of your staff report, you can see what it will look like.
Okay. Okay, are there any further speakers on this matter?
May I just make one quick remark, which is, this is, after all, being processed as a commercial development permit, so you could see why there's a little question here about...
Yeah, I had the same thought, actually.
I was telecom exempt.
Yeah. Okay, anyone else? All right, then we'll close the public hearing and bring the matter back before the commission. What's the commission's pleasure? Yes.
I'd like to move the staff recommendation with the modified conditions of approval.
Second.
But I'd like to just ask one question of staff. It seems in reading the material that our wireless communications facilities ordinance is kind of out of date, in that a lot of the exemptions we have to make are because what we require in our ordinance is no longer would violate PUC guidelines or requirements. Is there any thought to update that ordinance? I mean, I understand that that would be quite a process to do that, and I'm not suggesting that that's the right thing to do. I was just wondering what the thoughts were in the department about this.
We're aware that there's some anachronisms in the ordinances. However, the planning director has established a sort of criteria for amending some of the ordinances of the county code, and I don't know where this might be. I know it's certainly not at the top of the list.
Well, probably should it be, I suppose. Okay, thank you.
I just have one question, since you pointed out the photos on pages 134 through 137. On pages 136 and 137, kind of off in the distance, you know, there's a what looks like a pole, you know, sort of to the right, I guess, of the pole where the antenna would go. I'm just curious, do you know what that is?
Off in the distance, do you mean the one that's kind of lower down?
Yeah.
It's just another utility pole.
That's a utility pole?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, we had a motion and a second. Are there any other comments from commissioners? Then I don't think we need a roll call on this, so I'll just call the question. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. And that carries unanimously, 4-0 with one absent. So Congratulations.
The next item on your agenda is item number 12. This is a public hearing to consider updating regulations in the Santa Cruz County Code and amend related general plan and local coastal program policies. This is a proposal to update the regulations in the code as follows. Part one, amend chapter 1310 to provide new regulations for nonconforming uses and structures and amend related general plan and local coastal program policies. Amend part two, amend regulations in chapter 1310 regarding commercial uses and parking standards. Part three, delete the amendment defining the word structure in chapter 1210 as it relates to soil report requirements, and amend geologic hazard regulations in chapter 1610 regarding when the county is authorized to require geologic review. Part four, revise the level four permit approval process in chapter 1810. Part five, clean up various provisions in chapter 1310 and 1311 of the Santa Cruz County Code. Chapters 1310, 1311, 1610, and 1810 are coastal implementing ordinances. The applicant is the County of Santa Cruz. This is applicable countywide, and the project planner is Annie Murphy. Annie?
Good morning, Commissioners. I'll make a few opening remarks. As you know, the planning staff has been involved in reworking the regulations that govern nonconforming uses and nonconforming structures, and in determining which commercial regulations can be modified to facilitate more flexible use of existing commercial structures to address both the establishment of new businesses in those buildings and the switching in and out of commercial tenants. The changes that we are proposing were the subject of a public workshop which your commission held last September. They have also been discussed by the Board of Supervisors on several occasions, most recently last October. They also were the subject of an extensive focus group process in which the staff met with experts, property owners, neighbors, environmental advocates, and other groups that are concerned about these issues. All of that input has been collected. Much of it is reflected in the proposed new nonconforming ordinance, the associated ordinance amendments, the associated general plan amendments that are all here for your consideration today. The staff presentation will be given by Annie Murphy and Jerry Bush, who will highlight for you the differences between the package of changes that your commission worked through last September and the more refined version that's before you today. Annie will begin with a discussion of the nonconforming ordinance. And I'm going to ask if the secretary would hand out a new copy of one of the letters.
A new one?
Yes, this okay. The previous copy didn't have the second page.
Good morning. So first I'll begin with a review of the proposed regulations for nonconforming uses and structures. As an older, well-established community, we have many legal nonconforming uses and structures. Acknowledging the value to the community that these many nonconforming uses and structures provide, the proposed regulations would allow and even encourage maintenance and improvements to these existing legal nonconforming uses and structures. The regulatory framework would also be streamlined, while at the same time requiring appropriate planning review for projects to address potential impacts. So let's first review the proposed regulations for nonconforming structures. One of the primary changes will be to increase flexibility for these structures, and this would be accomplished in part by replacing the current variance requirement for reconstruction with an administrative site development permit. And this would mean a discretionary review with no public hearing required. This change would facilitate improvements and repairs and increase flexibility, since many properties do not meet the special circumstances that are required for a variance to be approved. Conforming additions would be allowed with a building permit, replacing the current requirement for a discretionary review for large additions. Although the administrative discretionary process would increase flexibility for nonconforming structures, projects would still be conditioned, and neighbors would receive notices of the pending project. This would allow all potential impacts to be addressed. Reconstruction will be defined as altering more than 75% of the major structural components. 75% was determined to be an appropriate threshold for reconstruction, replacing the range of 75 to 80% in the earlier draft reviewed by your commission. For structures in locations with greater potential to impact neighboring properties, altering more than 50% of the major structural components would require an administrative site development permit. This lower review threshold allows the planning director or designee to impose appropriate conditions to protect neighboring parcels. The locations that are determined to have greater potential to impact neighboring properties are identified as structures over the property line, within 5 feet of an existing or future right-of-way, and nonconforming structures within a riparian corridor. As discussed earlier with your commission, adding nonconforming structures in riparian corridors to this category allows additional conditions to be required to protect the corridor. As recommended by your commission earlier, the separate definition for riparian corridor has been deleted, and the ordinance would refer back to the existing definition in Chapter 1630. The proposed ordinance does not alter existing requirements in this chapter for riparian corridor protection, including riparian exemptions. The proposed ordinance includes a provision that would allow the planning director to waive this lower review threshold and apply the same threshold that applies to other nonconforming structures if it can be determined that the proposed project would not impact public welfare or the environment. The proposed regulations provide a more compassionate approach for reconstruction after a catastrophic event. Replacement for most nonconforming structures would be allowed with a building permit only, as long as reconstruction or the replacement structure is not more nonconforming than the original. For structures in the specified locations with greater potential to impact neighboring properties, reconstruction would require administrative discretionary review. This would allow the projects to be conditioned to address potential impacts, including requiring greater conformance with current site standards where feasible. And this, or the ordinance also does allow the planning director to waive this requirement for discretionary review where it can be determined that the reconstruction or replacement would not impact general welfare or the environment. It should also be noted here that other reviews or permits may be required for reconstruction, such as geologic review. In terms of the methods for assessing and evaluating the alterations, as noted in September, the methods for this evaluation have been revised to consider the whole structure. The current approach focuses on assessing the changes to the non-conforming portion of the structure, focusing on the exterior walls, and these are measured according to each stud that is proposed to be altered. In the proposed approach, the whole structure would be evaluated in determining the extent of structural alterations. This provides a more reality-based assessment for reconstruction based on changes to the major structural components, and these would consist of the roof framing, the wall framing, the floor framing, and the foundation. In response to comments from the workshop and from your commission, the list of major structural components has been further streamlined to include only these components and excludes roofing materials, window glazing, interior walls, and sheetrock and other interior elements. As noted in the September workshop, administrative guidelines are being developed to determine whether a particular project would be considered reconstruction or would reach the threshold requiring additional review. The guidelines would include a worksheet which would be completed by the applicant to determine the type of review that may be required. The guidelines would weight each structural component, again the roof, exterior walls, floor framing, and foundation, to determine the extent to which the whole structure has been altered. The goals for the worksheet include that it would be easy to complete by a homeowner, designer, or architect using a standard set of plans, and would work for a variety of different structures and different types of projects, and would also provide a reasonable outcome for what should be considered reconstruction, what we like to consider as the straight-faced test for, for looking at structures. Keeping these administrative guidelines as administrative will allow the methods to be adjusted as needed to correct any issues raised by staff or the public. And staff met earlier this week with a small focus group of designers, architects, and land use consultants to review the proposed administrative guidelines. And the group appreciated the ongoing dialogue and efforts to provide a more readily accessible and easy-to-use worksheet. A few comments: the group supported the 75% threshold for reconstruction and the idea of weighting the different structural components, and they provided additional feedback regarding the methods we discussed for assessing alterations to structural components. Staff is currently evaluating these suggestions, and we will work, continue to work further with local experts as we develop and refine the worksheet. Staff will provide the completed worksheet and guidelines on the Planning Department website prior to implementing the proposed ordinance. So moving on now to a discussion of nonconforming uses, the goals for in the new regulations for nonconforming uses would be similar to those for nonconforming structures. And the new regulations would allow nonconforming uses to continue and would also allow improvements to structures accommodating the nonconforming use and allow changes to existing nonconforming uses with appropriate planning review. The proposed approach would also provide one set of regulations for nonconforming uses in all zone districts, similar to what is currently provided for residential nonconforming uses. So this shows a comparison of existing regulations for commercial nonconforming uses, which are quite restrictive, with the proposed regulations that would apply in all zone districts. And these changes will especially benefit commercial nonconforming uses due to the restrictive nature of existing regulations. So a few of the highlights: reconstruction of a building accommodating a nonconforming use would be allowed with a conditional use permit that includes a public hearing. Currently, this is not allowed for commercial nonconforming uses. Nonconforming rights would be retained as long as the use continues for at least 3 out of the past 5 years. In response to a recommendation provided at the workshop, nonconforming uses that have lost their nonconforming rights due to a lapse in use could be reestablished through a conditional use permit process with a public hearing. Change from one nonconforming use to another nonconforming use would be allowed, subject to an administrative use permit. In a recommended change to the ordinance that is provided to your commission this morning as an addition to your packet, and this is on page 17A and 54A and 55A of the handout, the provision in section 1310.261c2 in the earlier draft would allow a change from a nonconforming use to another more intensive nonconforming use. And we are recommending that this particular provision be deleted, and this is being recommended in order to protect neighboring properties from impacts that could result from a more intensive nonconforming use.
Could you say that again?
1310.261c2? C2. Yes.
Okay. And what are you deleting?
When you look at the, let me pull this up here one moment. So if you look at page 17 of your packet, you can look at just the ordinary packet. At the top of the page, at the bottom of that table on page 17, if you're looking at your original packet. So if you look at page 17 of your packet.
Of
your original packet.
Of the original.
Yeah, just so it's clear, you can see what's being deleted.
So is it the very last row in the table?
Yes, it's the last row of the table, exactly.
At the top.
Top of page 17.
So which?
It's this one.
Okay. That whole row?
Yes. So that last row on the top of page 17, that would allow a change from one nonconforming use to another nonconforming use with intensification. And based in part upon recommendation from County Council, we're recommending that that be deleted to protect neighboring properties from potential impacts that might result from a change of use with intensification.
So the current process would just remain as is?
There's a provision on page 16, if you look at the remainder of that table, and it does allow change of an existing nonconforming use to another nonconforming use with no intensification. So that would remain. So they would still be allowed to change to another nonconforming use as long as there's no intensification involved. Intensification includes things such as increase in parking requirements above a certain level, or use of hazardous materials or other, or noise increases, other things that would impact.
Changing from a retail to a restaurant, something like that?
If that did involve things such as increase in parking or a noise that was determined by the planning director to be substantial, then it could be considered intensification.
There, you'd actually, there's a definition of intensification that one would look at.
Okay.
And that's somewhere in
this. Yes. If you wanted to look at the definition of intensification of use, that is right here. Okay, that is on page 31 of your packet. And there are two definitions. This section 33, on page 31 of your packet, the definition for intensification of use commercial, and this would be any change or expansion of a non-residential use, which will result in both a greater than 10% increase in parking need and more than two spaces, or which is determined by the planning director, likely to result in a significant new or increased impact due to potential traffic generation, noise, smoke, glare, odors, hazardous materials, water use, and or sewage generation, so being intensification of use.
So just so I'm clear, so if there is an intensification of use, the process would be current process?
If it's a non-conforming use and it's proposed to be an intensification, then you would need to rezone to get into a zoning district that would allow that use.
Oh.
And that's actually consistent with the current ordinance, which also does not have a provision allowing for change of use with intensification.
Okay.
And in the revisions provided to your packet this morning, there's one additional revision being recommended, and this involves pre-existing parcels. And if you look on page, you can see the provision. This is page 13A, the replacement page, and page 13 of your original packet. So the previous draft of the ordinance that your commission reviewed in September included a provision in section 1310.260(c)(4). And if you look on page 13 of your original packet, this is number 4 there, close to the bottom of the page, titled Pre-Existing Parcels. So in the previous draft of the ordinance reviewed by your commission, this section 1310.260(c)(4) stated that a parcel that does not conform to minimum site area, width, or frontage as required by the zone district, quote unquote, may be developed if the listed criteria are met. And in fact, there are other factors that must be considered in addition to conformance to these standards to determine whether a parcel may be developed. So in the proposed change provided on page 13A, this section would be revised to state that a legal parcel that does not conform to the minimum site area width or frontage as required by the regulations of the zone district should not be considered undevelopable solely because of a lack of conformance to one or more of these standards. So this change would clarify that additional factors maybe need to be considered before it can be determined whether a parcel can be developed.
So is that taking into account a parcel that may meet this definition but maybe sits on a riparian corridor or something?
Yes, environmental factors, conformance with the Subdivision Map Act, other issues that have to be considered. Okay, moving on then, the proposal before you today also includes new proposed amendments to the general plan and local coastal program. As noted in September, the proposed ordinance is generally consistent with general plan policies regarding commercial nonconforming uses and residential nonconforming structures. However, the current general plan does not provide overall policy guidance for nonconforming uses and structures in all zone districts. Additionally, several of the existing policies are inconsistent or difficult to implement. Therefore, staff is proposing to add language to the land use element of the general plan to provide broad policy guidance for nonconforming uses and structures consistent with what is being proposed in the ordinance. Staff is also proposing to revise existing general plan policies for commercial and light industrial uses and for residential nonconforming structures to improve the internal consistency of general plan policies and to provide greater consistency with the proposed ordinance revisions. Other ordinance revisions included in the proposal, geologic review criteria. The existing code provides a definition of development for Chapter 1620 to determine the types of projects for which geologic review may be required. Reconstruction is one type of project that may require geologic review. Consistent with the approach for nonconforming structures and uses, the threshold for reconstruction that would authorize the county to require geologic review has been set at 75%. The proposal also includes revisions to the level 4 approval process that would streamline the review process, reduce processing time and costs, by noticing the project only once, similar to that required for other approval levels, and would also publish a notice on the Planning Department website rather than in local papers. Upon the recommendation from several of the commissioners to retain the current requirement that property owners within 300 feet and residents within 100 feet continue to receive notices, the draft ordinance has been revised to retain this noticing requirement. And the proposal also includes several cleanup items to the county code, consistent with efforts to provide an accurate and up-to-date county code. Additional cleanup provisions have been added since your last review, correcting typographical errors in code references and increasing consistency with state law. These minor cleanups are reviewed in more detail in the initial study of your packet, page 127. Okay, and now Jerry will discuss commercial changes and changes to parking standards.
So this section of the presentation will focus on amendments to facilitate changes of use and on updates to retail, business, and medical office parking standards to better reflect actual parking demand. And my report will focus on the high points of the proposed amendments and changes since the September 14th public hearing. There's no changes proposed to the draft commercial uses chart presented at the September workshop, which is on page 25 of your packet. These revisions would expand level one changes of use in town plan areas to town plans outside the San Lorenzo Valley, such as Soquel and Aptos. It would allow level one approvals without intensification in the CT and VA districts congruent with the C1 and C2 districts and PA district. And for a new use on a vacant parcel, it would raise the threshold for a public hearing currently at 2,000 square feet building to 5,000 square feet.
We're proposing changes to draft parking regulations. Our recommendation in September was to exempt changes of use that generated an increase in parking of more than 4 spaces or 20%. We ran some examples on that and felt that that exemption was too high. So we're now recommending an exemption of 2 spaces and retaining the 10% exemption that's currently in the county code. Importantly, however, the most important and beneficial change that we're making is that we're going to require provision of new parking greater than those 2 space and 10% thresholds, only for the additional increment of demand. Currently, if you want to increase demand over what's the current parking provided at a given site, you have to bring the entire site up to current parking or we can't approve it. So this benefits you, your application, in that you only have to provide parking for the additional increment that's associated with your particular use. So I can show you an example of how that would work. Suppose you have a commercial structure with non-conforming parking right now. So let's say that the space you're moving into is 2,400 square feet. If you're going from business office at the currently recommended parking standard of 1 space per 300 square feet, the parking requirement would be 8 spaces for the existing use. And if you wanted to put a medical office in there, change the use to medical, which would have a parking standard of 1 space per 200 square feet, which is a greater parking requirement, that would require 12 spaces for that space. So in order to move in, you would be required to provide 4 additional spaces. Now the question that may jump out at you from this particular slide is, how can I do that? At this site, it would perhaps be challenging to find a way to add 4 spaces, but at some sites it may be feasible to do so where there's undeveloped area on the parcel. And there may be other ways of meeting those 4 spaces, such as implementing a transportation demand management program or a shared parking contract on site or on a nearby site. But in any case, it'll facilitate changes of use to require parking only for the additional increment of demand that's incurred by your change of use or physical expansion.
Can I ask a question? Sorry, Jeff, can I ask?
Yeah, go ahead.
This site doesn't look like there's any street parking surrounding it, but if the site does have street parking, do you count that?
No, street parking is not counted.
So it has to be parking lot parking?
Correct.
And
what's the philosophy behind that? Well, the parking standards are all predicated on providing off-street parking. That's sort of the fundamental principle of parking standards, is they're based on what you have to provide. I think it's assumed that there's going to be a certain sort of base level demand for on-street parking that's generated by, I don't know, just sort of the general demand in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So historically, parking standards are based on off-street parking.
And I think the direction that you're going in is a good one. And I know that, you know, neighborhoods are different as to how much street parking they have. There are some areas in the county where there's ample street parking. It seems like at some point in the future, there are projects that have, you know, limited parking on site but are surrounded by a lot of street parking, that it might be fair to be able to include that in some way. But that's just a side comment.
If I could piggyback on that, I'm glad Rachel brought that up. I thought that was possibly something that could be incorporated in the, what was it called, the parking demand management?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in certain cases in which that would be permissible, where it's an obvious demonstration of lack of spaces, I would personally be amenable to that, just anything to, you know, promote business in the area. And I think that's one of my biggest compliments to staff is that, you know, we're really doing a lot towards promoting the development of business, and I think that suggestion would only further that aim.
Thank you for that. And as you'll see in a couple of slides, we are removing the current ceiling, or proposing to remove the current ceiling on reductions associated with strong transportation demand and parking demand management programs installed on site.
Commissioner Mann.
I'm not suggesting this, but let's say I'm the property owner and I need four spaces, so I come to the planning department. So I'm going to remove that planting, that landscaping, and put in four spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have any control over that aspect of it?
Oh, absolutely. Landscaping is fundamental to most conditional use approvals and is addressed in the conditions of approval. And it will be, there are certain requirements in the county code for landscaping on sites.
Good, thank you.
So, I'm sorry, back to this example, it makes perfect sense to me, but I'm curious, what's being proposed, but what currently would be, how does this differ from what would currently be required? I guess I'm not.
Well, it's different in that currently, if your use would generate more parking, if your proposed use would require more parking than the existing use, we would not approve the new use unless you could bring the entire parcel up to current parking standards. Not just provide the additional increment that's associated with your use. So we had a stricter view of parcels that we would allow no increase in intensity or physical expansion of use, period, if the parking was non-conforming, unless you brought the entire site up to current standards. So it was it was punitive in the sense that the degree of increase in parking demand that's generated by your use, the increased intensity associated with your use, is usually less than, or often, you know, fewer parking spaces than bringing the whole center up to use. So we're trying to disconnect the existing circumstances at the site and simply make them no worse by requiring you to provide the parking associated with your use.
So in this example, so if this site were currently like under parked, but they would propose something like this, the idea here is that if you can provide the four additional spaces, you're not making it any worse.
Correct.
And then it can be allowed, as
correct.
Opposed to the center as a whole would need to maybe find more space.
Okay. That's correct.
And we found that particular issue to be a real impediment for businesses changing in and out of a given space. The space was built many years ago, so it isn't conforming. And we weren't looking at just the increment. So many of these older centers were prevented from having that sort of flow through of commerce.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
We're proposing changes to the draft parking standards. At the 914 workshop, we recommended a standard of one space per 250 square feet for retail. After receiving a number of suggestions, staff reexamined the standard and determined that one space per 300 square feet better represented evidence of actual parking demand. Staff also reviewed the proposed standard for medical offices, and in light of new data from a local site where peak parking demand was one space per 208 square feet for medical, our current proposal tightens the proposed standards for medical office from one space per 225 to one space per 200. The recommended amendment to change business office parking, going from the current standard of one space per 200 square feet down to one space per 300 square feet, which is a more relaxed standard, is unchanged from our September recommendation. And having the same standard for business, that is 300, for business office, service, and retail will additionally facilitate changes in use between these uses. Could I get the pointer? Can you turn it on?
Sorry, you
guys
got it.
Is this the pointer?
No, I'm sorry.
You forgot it. Oh, okay. No, okay. Oh, okay. We have an inboard pointer here. So this is a chart that compares the existing standard, which is in light blue, and the legend is to the right of the to the right over here. The existing standard is in light blue. The proposed standard is in purple, and these standards are compared in this chart to the Institute of Transportation Engineers' evidence of parking demand. They go out and actually count the number of cars and spaces for different uses. And they come up with an average and an 85th percentile. The 85th percentile is the level below which 85% of the sites fall. So you can see for office buildings, where's my little mouse here? There we go. You can see that for office buildings, and the uses are listed across the bottom, the proposed standard in purple is very closely aligned to the 85th percentile, the ITE 85th percentile. Whoops. For medical office, which is right here, we are proposing a standard that's slightly more conservative than the ITE evidence because of the local evidence that we have for parking demand. And I'll note that at the right of the chart, you can see the standard expressed in floor area per parking space. So that's the current standard is 200 for both business and medical. Well, for medical, the current standard is practitioner-based, which we're getting away from. We're proposing to keep supermarkets at the current standard of one parking space per 200 square feet, which is slightly more generous than the evidence of parking demand, but it's close. And that's the current standard, and we're not proposing to change that. However, we're proposing to bring general retail more closely aligned. Again, look at the purple bar over general retail, and comparing that with the green bars for the 85th percentile of parking demand evidence, you can see we're bringing that much more in line with the evidence. And finally, we're proposing no changes to the additional improvements that we recommended in September that would allow greater flexibility for shared parking, remove the 25% maximum for transportation demand management programs, and allow one or two spaces to go away if you're improving accessibility. So that concludes my presentation, if there are no further questions.
I guess I have one question as it pertains to the medical offices.
Right.
I'm just wondering, because I know we're going from 1 to 225 and now to 1 to 200.
Right.
And I'm not trying to split hairs or anything, but I'm just wondering in light of a recent conversation I had with Deputy Director Jane Nguyen of Health Services, and we were talking about the low-income health plan currently in place and how that's essentially a bridge to reform for when Obamacare comes into effect. And she cited one of the major problems as being come 2014, we're going to, by federal law, be required to serve many more people who mm-hmm. otherwise wouldn't have had health care. And so I would anticipate there's going to be a mini boom of medical offices that come into place. And given that increased demand, I'm still wondering if it'd be more conducive to meeting that demand to allow business medical offices to open up with less stringent requirements. That's what I'm, you know, currently inclined towards, but I was just wondering staff's thoughts on that, if that was something that's been taken into consideration.
We have been discussing this change. Staff has expressed concern about making sure that enough parking is available at the site of a medical office to accommodate everyone that needs to go to the doctor. That being said, we want to allow medical offices to move into sites as efficiently as possible. So it's a balancing act.
Yeah.
One thing that is enters into the equation is the fact that one of the drivers of medical office parking is the number of employees, the number of practitioners, mm-hmm. as it is with business office. In fact, there's almost an equal correlation with number of employees as there is to space. And so transportation demand management can be a very effective tool for making the grade in terms of your parking situation. These standards, I think we should continue to, the county is currently studying transportation demand management programs and transportation-oriented development in the Soquel corridor where a lot of our mm-hmm. commercial use yeah. is. So this is going to be a continuing focus of the county, and if we need to fine-tune the standard, we can do so. May even be that the county will be able to gather more evidence and to support the standard as time goes by, and keep an eye on trying to get the standard accurate. Your point also, just not to belabor it too much, but it is based on peak parking demand, so the trade-off is, well, maybe there's a few spaces not available, the parking may be juiced at peak demand, but during the rest of the day it's okay, so that can come back to managing your appointments. So there's a trade-off there.
And I'll just add, we kept going back and forth on this one, actually. You know, one for 225, one for 200. It's not that much different. And so it really is kind of a policy decision in terms of just how well you want to ensure that parking is available, as Jerry said, during the peak time. I think that we could, if you were inclined to, be more aggressive, if you will, with adjusting the rate, I think that we wouldn't necessarily have a problem with supporting one for 200 as against one for 225 as against one for 200.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Arandrew.
I took a course in operations research at one time, and there was a lot of queuing theory that went on. Types of use, and that's exactly what we're seeing here. You know, I mean, do we have a model that, you know, you put in so many square feet of retail, so many square feet of grocery stores and whatever, so that allows us to estimate with a little more scientific accuracy? I mean, it is really a complex kind of mm-hmm. thing, and I applaud you for the kind of things you're doing. I use that Best Buy Safeway complex on 41st quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And that seems to handle the mixed uses. Starbucks is always busy, diminishes, and then you have several restaurants and Best Buy business hours. So you're comfortable with the model that's been developed to assess the parking?
We're pretty comfortable with the well, it's a step in the right direction to begin to base our parking standards on evidence rather than just what everyone else is doing, for example. And we're going to continue to attempt to use science to make our parking as accurate as possible. There's a trade-off between oceanic parking lots and between not providing enough parking so that people have to walk.
And another observation I would make, again, going back to the examples I've cited, the business there is generally car-driven, so to speak. Because people are not going to, in the old days, when I grew up, you could put some shopping bags together and go to Grand Central Market in downtown LA and come back using public transit. But that's no longer the case. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the transit opportunities for these kind of parking situations, I think are of minimal use, unfortunately.
Right. It's probably, I mean, this issue is one that we're going to continue to study and refine. Some communities have begun to use temporary overflow areas in parking lots to address peak seasonal demand or peak daily demand that also serve, as a sort of a green space or filter area. So there's increasing sophistication in the use and benefits and visual effect of parking lots on the community, and we're continuing to examine implementation of those.
Just a quick question on the accessibility upgrades. When you say allow accessibility upgrades, is the idea there that if a business going in needs to provide an accessible space that would result in the removal or reduction, let's say, in the number of spaces, that would be allowed? Is that the idea?
Correct.
Okay. Because that's, I believe that's kind of what's happening in a lot of situations.
Yeah, that can occasionally, I mean, we don't want to see it done gratuitously. If you have room to restripe your parking lot and not drop a space, we're going to encourage that, certainly. And the owners tend to do that, too. They want to have adequate parking for their businesses. At a small site, it will help people if they need to lose a space in order to add a loading zone to a parking space and provide access to mobility impaired people.
Okay. So,
Annie's going to continue.
Okay, I was curious where we were in the report, and then I think we might take a break. Is that kind of the protocol?
So yes, we're almost done with our presentation. Environmental review has been completed for this project, and a draft negative declaration has been prepared. In the review, particular attention was given to potential impacts to visual resources, transportation and traffic, and land use. No potentially significant impacts were identified, and no comments have been received on the initial study or negative declaration. To conclude then, staff believes that the proposed ordinance and related general plan amendments, including the revisions recommended today, will help to accomplish several important community objectives. The new proposed regulations for nonconforming structures and uses provide additional flexibility while requiring discretionary review as appropriate to protect public welfare and the environment. The related general plan amendments provide policy guidance to support this new approach. The revisions to regulations for commercial uses and selected parking standards also increase flexibility and provide an important step toward improving the regulatory environment for local businesses. Providing a whole structure approach for evaluating changes to a structure provides a more reality-based and workable solution. Therefore, staff is recommending that your commission open the public hearing and adopt the resolution recommending that the Board of Supervisors adopt the negative declaration, approve the proposed ordinance, including the revisions to Section 1310.260(c)(4) and Section 1310.261(c)(2), and approve the related general plan local coastal program amendments. Thank you, and we're available for any questions.
Okay, thank you. Do we want to do questions now? Take a break? Okay, I think the commission's going to take a break. Why don't we reconvene at 11:45? So 10 minutes. So one question I had was on these administrative use permits, which were discretionary, as I understood, those were discretionary reviews. So if an applicant was dissatisfied with the decision that was made, what would be their recourse? Would they appeal to the zoning administrator, the planning commission? What would happen with these?
That would be appealed as per the standard appeal process for a level 4 permits. So those would be appealed to the zoning administrator, and then it could, you know, go on up through the chain if they weren't satisfied with them. They continue the appeal all the way to the Board of Supervisors.
Okay. And for those particular types of applications that would have this discretionary review, I just wanted to be clear on the noticing for those. Would that be that 100-foot, 300-foot that was described in the presentation?
Yes, that's correct. It would be 300-foot notice to property owners and 100 feet to residents, and that basically retains the existing process in the county code currently. And then in terms of the publishing of the notice, that would be to reduce processing time and cost. Currently, it's published in local newspapers, and that would be revised to be published on the Planning Department website.
Okay. And then I think I may have asked this back the last time we were discussing this, but my memory is not too clear on that. If a non-conforming structure was determined to have been built without permits, when permits should have been obtained, is that treated differently than a non-conforming structure that simply is non-conforming because the zoning regulations have changed? In other words, this would not grandfather in illegal construction that gets discovered or uncovered as a result of someone coming in to legalize a non-conforming structure.
That's correct. The definition of non-conforming is legal non-conforming. If you needed a permit, and one wasn't obtained, then you're not covered by this.
So there's a different. They go down a different path.
They go down a code compliance path.
A code compliance path. Okay. And then I really like this whole structure approach. I mean, I think that's definitely the way to go. I'm just curious, when you came up with this, were you able to determine if this type of an approach is used in other jurisdictions? I'm just curious if you found whether, you know, other jurisdictions maybe using this and you know, what their experience has been. Has it been working?
We did survey in the beginning.
Yes, we did survey a number of other jurisdictions. I don't think we found any that exactly use this approach, and we contacted several jurisdictions and didn't seem to find a good answer. So we developed this, I think, somewhat independently and also working with focus groups intensively to try and determine what really made sense in terms of what we wanted to look at and how the changes to these could be evaluated in assessing overall structural changes.
Okay. And then I know you you provided some revised sheets. You went through one or two of them, but did you want to just explain what was changing on these pages or point out what the corrections were? I think you did on page 17.
There are only two.
Okay.
And I believe we discussed them both. One was about pre-existing parcels and making that language be more accurate. And the other was changing that chart to addressing changing from a non-conforming use to another non-conforming use that had intensification and deleting that.
Okay.
And I can, if you want me to identify the specific provisions, I can certainly do that on the pages that were provided.
No, I think I see them here now.
Okay.
I guess that was my questions for now. Any questions? Okay, sure.
I just had a couple of questions on page 17 of the packet, and then again on page 20. So under the procedures for administrative use permit, and then also under the procedures for reconstruction of nonconforming structures, replacement of nonconforming structures, there's a bullet point that says that you have to find that the proposed project not significantly impair economic development goals or key land use goals of the general plan. For both of those, could you give me an example of what that would be pertaining to?
Yeah, that's to allow the decision makers or the staff to consider if the parcel or if the project is in an area that has been the subject of some kind of economic development plan or study, and it's there have been recommendations made for the area to be used in a certain way in the future, and putting if you have a house that's nonconforming in a commercial area and it's the only residence there, you might want to consider that before extending the nonconforming use. You want to look at what is the future use of the area. So if there's something that's in the works, you'd want to be able to factor that in.
Okay. And then I had another question based on one of our letters that I just read. I think it was pertaining to page 17, number 7. Ron Powers asked, interpreted it in one way, and I just wanted to know if staff agreed with that interpretation. I didn't quite understand what it meant, but it was number 7, which is talking about changes to another nonconforming use. And in his letter, he's saying that, interpreting it, that it indicates that if it's feasible to have a conforming use, then this proposed nonconforming use could be denied. Is that how I should read that?
I would say that's true. It's not the nonconforming use, but whatever project is being proposed. I'm sorry, this is, let me back up, you're correct. This is talking about changing from one nonconforming use to another. So yes, we do want, we're trying to, you know, in terms of changing to the nonconforming use, overall we do want to facilitate conforming uses. So if there is some way where it's feasible to provide a conforming use, then the change to the nonconforming use would be denied. But certainly we would interpret that quite broadly, including economic conditions. So we would consider the needs of the applicant, and if it was, you know, for example, they wanted to change to a nonconforming use, and due to economic conditions, there wasn't a conforming use that they could change, then we would consider that as well in approving. So it is a fairly broad finding.
So the situation I'm thinking of, if you have a commercial space that's vacant for a long time and had a nonconforming use in there, and then say another person wants to come in with another nonconforming use, but the place had been vacant for a long time, and so would that be taken into consideration, the fact that it would be somebody wanting to make use of a commercial space that's been empty for a while but may still be nonconforming. So would number 7 preclude that new nonconforming use from going in, or are there other considerations that might allow it? I guess is what I'm asking.
I don't think it would preclude it because certainly, you know, in their application, we'd look at what they're proposing and you know, have them address whether there are other conforming uses that might be feasible, but if for some reason it wasn't feasible due to economic conditions or, example, like the parking on the site, they couldn't provide additional parking that would be required for conforming use, of those sorts of factors would be considered.
Okay.
And of course, for changing to a parcel that's vacant, we also have to assess whether the nonconforming rights had been retained based on the amount of time it had elapsed.
Right. So I just wanted, so it sounds like this is not like a definitive, but more, could be looked at more broadly.
Correct.
Depending on what the circumstances are.
Correct.
Okay. That's all I have right now.
Okay. All right, well that, then what we'll do now is we will open the public hearing on this item. So if members of the public, anyone would like to address the commission, now is your chance. Again, if you could just state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Nancy Macy, and I am chair of the Environmental Committee for the San Lorenzo Valley, which is a project of the Valley Women's Club, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to speak to the Planning Commission. It's wonderful that we have a process that allows public input on issues of such importance, and the one of streamlining our county codes is so vital to everyone. It's very important. I'm grateful to be here. I was struck by the complexity of the interrelationships between the changes being proposed and the coastal regulations and the hazardous zoning regulations and all of that. It's very complex, and I kind of had the feeling that there really are too many issues being addressed at one time to have a full understanding. But there is one major area that we're concerned with in the San Lorenzo Valley. As stewards of the San Lorenzo River watershed, we're especially concerned with the ongoing negative impacts on the need to improve and enforce protection of riparian corridors. And I'm very impressed with the effort that's been made by all of you to protect the riparian areas and in the decisions you've made so far. I'm very grateful for that. I'm very concerned, however, that some of the language relating to the nonconforming uses is too open-ended, and this will actually undermine our planners' abilities to say no when an exception is proposed or a variance requested, and that is already a problem even under current language. In the past 2 years, over 52 exceptions have been made to the riparian corridor ordinances. So those protections have been, in essence, lessened in at least 52 incidences in the county. Significant changes in either the size or location of homes or other structures, the removal of trees right along the riparian corridor has been allowed. And as you well know, that increases the temperature of streams, undermining salmonid habitat, and our salmonids are threatened, so that's of concern to the county. We've seen this happen. There's a large home rebuilt along Zianti Creek near the fire department with an extra structure that, you know, when I look at it, I feel that that was probably not part of a legally allowed variance. And there's another place up in Mompico where you can see that the house is literally on the creek, and expansions and further grading has been allowed. So I just worry that the language needs to be kept very tight to empower our planners to say no to inappropriate expansions in riparian corridors. Those riparian corridors are really tricky. Homes were built in ages past between a road and the creek, and there's no place to go. And in this modern day and age, people want more space. They want a bigger house. They want two bedrooms or three bedrooms. They want two bathrooms instead of one. And so we understand their desire to do that. But our planners need to be empowered to say, I'm sorry, but this expansion is not legal. This expansion is not allowed because we have to protect the creeks and the streams, the seasonal waterways, as well as the year-round waterways. So it's important to look at the language and make sure that it is tight enough so that our planners have that power. Thank you very much.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Can you cite an example of where the language you feel is maybe not strong enough, or is?
I'm sorry, I didn't bring my sheet that had that written on it. I just brought my letter.
Are you referring to the section here? This is where it mentions.
Can I ask staff a related question?
Sure.
Ms. Macy is looking at them. So it was my understanding that, so what we're talking about here in the situation she brought up, homes on, you know, between a road and a creek or whatever. And so what we're mostly looking at, I thought, was non-conforming structures who, you know, not that they want to expand, but like get burned down or, you know, need to remodel, but not expand the footprint. That's kind of how I've been reading it, but.
The one in Ziani is exactly that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So could we go over that a little bit more so we're more clear on what the situation is that?
And contrast it with the present regulations.
Thank you.
So what the ordinance would do for non-conforming structures that are in riparian corridors, it would put them in that category that's subject to a lower threshold of review. So it would allow planners, a decision maker, to add additional conditions to protect the riparian corridor. And this would be for projects, for example, where it may not otherwise trigger a riparian exception. But it doesn't change in any way the existing requirements in Chapter 16.30. So projects that are required now to obtain a riparian exception would continue to be required. So we, in our understanding, it actually strengthens requirements for protection for riparian corridors because it would allow those additional conditions to be applied.
Yeah, and so contrasting it with the existing regulations, we're talking about a non-conforming structure, say, within a riparian corridor. Existing, they could leave half of the non-conforming wall up, take the rest of the structure down and rebuild it, and not need any sort of review, just a building permit. So this actually allows for an increased level of scrutiny on reconstruction or changes to a non-conforming structure in the riparian area, because if they alter 50% or more of the major structural components, they need to get a site development permit. And that allows us, as Annie mentioned, to impose conditions of approval, potentially, you know, work with them on better siting or add conditions to require riparian restoration and that type of thing. So it's an increased level of review for non-conforming structures in riparian areas or located across property lines within 5 feet of right-of-way, that type of thing. Much more increased than presently under the present regulations.
So I'm wondering
if that clarifies things.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. All right, that helps. All right, well, I just want to make sure that everybody's on the same page here, both planning and the Planning Commission, that riparian corridors are of an extraordinary high priority, and again, that there actually be the I don't know if political is the right word, but the political support that will allow planners to be strong in that area. Because I worry about that when I see 52 exceptions over 2 years, some of which may or may not have been good for the riparian area. Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Kevin Collins. I've been following this process since it started in 2007, and this would be the third phase of what Tom Burns, the planning director at the time, had originally explained to the Board of Supervisors when they went through the, I forget the term, I think it was code simplification or something, but in any case, the documents you have don't refer backward, but I just want to remind the commissioners, especially those who weren't here at the time, this has been going on since 2007. And this, I don't know if this is the final phase that planning has in mind at the moment, but in any case, it is quite broad. We're going all the way from parking in commercial lots to redevelopment of nonconforming rural houses deep in the mountains, and it's all in one package. I would have personally prefer, because I find it very difficult to understand all this, even the sections that I personally am paying attention to. I have a hard time really understanding the implications of it. And it's one thing to read the code section and understand the English, and it's another thing altogether to know what the implications of that are going to be 3 years later when someone comes in and requests a permit or an exception. So I would have preferred to see this divided up at least into two sections rather than provided all at once. But setting that down for the moment, the organization I represent, which incidentally is not the Sierra Club at this point, is most interested in the rural areas of the county and natural environments. And we focus primarily on wildlife, water resources, and rural development standards. So I'm not here to talk about how many parking spots might be necessary for a dentist's office. I'm strictly concerned about the impacts to the natural environment, primarily in the mountain ranges around us. So one of the things I've become aware of in the last few years is that there appears to be a legal interpretation that's taken hold that essentially every parcel of record is developable, regardless of its lack of conformity to site standards. Now, I suppose this wouldn't apply to a 25 by 100 foot happy land lot perched up on the side of a mountain without any road access, but when it comes to these remaining undeveloped lots, this commission regularly issues variances to the site standards, the riparian, geologic, and sensitive habitat ordinances don't need a variance, they just need staff approval. And these things are being passed out in a steady stream, and the people that I work with are quite concerned about it because there's a cumulative impact that isn't reflected in the CEQA documents that are attached to these. I would hope you would take a look at the findings that are necessary, for instance, for a riparian exception. They are extremely open-ended, and these exceptions are issued regularly. I mean, what is going on now is that we have all these little cabins, small houses, as Nancy Macy was referring to, that are hemmed in between roads and streams on parcels that were never envisioned to meet modern site standards. In fact, they'll have parking, a septic system, and the building and its outbuildings on a lot that is probably a quarter of the size it would be necessary to meet modern site standards. But nonetheless, it's a parcel of record. Someone comes in and they want to redevelop the house on that site. And in some instances, essentially build a new structure. Now, when someone invests that kind of money, they want to add square footage. And I've seen situations where the strategy will be for the developer, the property owner, the architect, whatever, whoever it is that comes up with a strategy, to add, say, non-habitable space to that structure. I saw one of these done near me where a lot of, quote, non-habitable space was added to the building. So the building is substantially larger. 2 years later, someone pops in a couple windows, throws a heater vent, and suddenly that house has another bedroom or two in it on the same site with the same restrictions under which it was approved initially. So this, in my view, this is a progressive process that has no backstop on it. And I don't see a backstop in the language that's proposed here. And just so I don't go on forever, let me just jump to the third point I wanted to make, which has to do with our changes to the geologic hazard ordinance. I don't understand them. I can't claim to know what planning is proposing here, but the geologic hazard ordinance, it may be a major nuisance. And I used to be a general contractor in this county, so I know how difficult it is to come up with the money for soils reports and geologic surveys. And in some cases, they have probably been required when they might not have been necessary. But nonetheless, we have parcels all over this mountain range that are either on top of a landslide or in its path. And there's a building that I presented to the Board of Supervisors during the last one of these code change proposals that was built with permits on a known debris slide by driving caissons through the debris slide. It's perched on the edge of a slope that's, I'm not exaggerating, it's 100% slope. That means at 45 degrees above the horizontal. You can't walk up that hill to that house. And the plumbing that was run through the foundation is now snapped off and separated. The drains that were intended to keep the front door from becoming a flood entranceway for the parking area that was created in front of it. These are real situations. And when this much latitude is granted for the redevelopment of sites, new problems are being created. It's been a long time since the slab of earth that fell into Love Creek detached, but this is going to happen again. And I hope that the geologic hazard ordinance is not somehow being having its effectiveness reduced, because most people who don't live in the mountains don't understand how landslide-ridden this mountain range is. It is essentially, its entire landform is created by the process of landslide. This is not the Sierra Nevada. This isn't granite. This is just uplifted ocean bottom. And it's extremely fragile. It's as erosion-prone as any other mountain range in the state of California. And this is a geologic fact. So anyway, please be careful with the geologic hazard ordinance, it's going to come back and bite you. Thanks again.
Could you maybe just address the what I thought I read about the geologic hazard was it was minor sort of cleanup language to conform it with the state building code. But maybe I misread?
There are a couple different changes. The one that has to do with the building code. Involves when soils reports can be required. And we aren't changing or proposing to change when soil reports would be required. We're proposing to change where that regulation lives in the code. We had it in the code as an exception in the building code, and we had guidelines that staff uses to describe and to direct when a soils report can be required. And that was redundant, and it's not a great idea to have the exceptions in Chapter 12. So the guidelines will remain, and they're adequate to keep asking for soils reports in the way that we currently do them. So from my point of view, that one is non-substantive. We are making some other proposed changes to 1610. And specifically to take the definition that we've crafted of what is a reconstruction and have that one be in 1610 instead of the one that's currently there, because we've got this proliferation of definitions going that's really been difficult for the public to understand and ourselves to administer. So the practical effect of that will be stating that the staff has the authority to require geologic and geotechnical engineering reports when it's a reconstruction, according to that definition. They also can require it at any level if the building is recognized to be unsafe in some way. There is some language that specifically addresses slope stability in the definition of development in 1610 that is being added, and that's on page 35 of your packet, number 7. Any repair, reconstruction, etc., affecting any structure that is located on a site with slope stability concerns, such as sites affected by existing or potential debris flows. Those are situations in which geologic work can be required.
You said page 35?
Of the old?
It begins on 35.
Well, the bottommost number is 35.
It's number 7 on 35.
It's what?
Number 7 on 35.
It's of attachment 1 to exhibit A.
Yeah.
It's the bottom of page 35 and the top of 36.
Bottom. Yeah.
Section 17 of the ordinance.
Yeah, section 17.
So if you have page 35 of your packet, number 7 at the bottom of the page.
There's a strikeout number 9 in front of 7.
Yes. Correct. Yes.
I'm looking at that.
Okay.
Any repair or alteration meets the criteria. Oh, located on, okay, number 2. I didn't see that. Located on the site. All right. Okay. Other speakers that would like to?
Good morning. My name is Eric Hammer. I'm a resident of the 5th District, and I want to thank Kathy for putting together some really good focus groups. I was a member of several focus groups on the issues that are in front of you. As Nancy mentioned earlier, and Kevin also, the 5th District is very much unique in its business community and its environment. And I'd like to talk to two points. One, parking and transportation in regards to businesses. Being president of Boulder Creek Business Association, I understand some of the difficulties around change of use and non-conforming structures in the business community and how it relates to parking. As mentioned, off-street parking doesn't count for adequate parking spaces. And if you take a look at Boulder Creek, Ben Lomond, Felton, Brookdale, to a point, they're historic towns. And, you know, they've got boardwalks, or used to have boardwalks, where you put your rail, your horses up and tie it up. So it makes it very difficult to produce the amount of parking spaces that are needed when you make that change. So I think, I know two businesses right now in Boulder Creek that have been having a difficulty with changing usage in a building because they don't have ample parking, yet it reduces, you know, the economic growth of our community up there. So I think we just need to really take a look at that. The flip side of that, too, is sustainable transportation. And it was talked about in the transportation demand that transportation management that Jerry was talking to, demand management. And it was also mentioned by Mr. Garcia about the fact that Obamacare is going to increase the amount of patrons looking to seek services. But the flip side of that, you're creating policy that is going to be implemented for years to come. And with that policy, you also got to take a look at sustainable transportation. The idea is to reduce the cars on the road, reduce the need for parking lots, yet increase the availability of goods and services. So one example of that is taking a look at, if you're setting a policy today where you have to have a multitude of parking spots in smaller areas so that people can drive and park, you're allowing people to continue to drive. Where what we're trying to do at that same point is mass transit. So if you create a policy that limits the amount of parking, yet the offset of that in another branch of government, and I know it's not you guys, you got everybody has to work together, and this doesn't fall on you, is a voucher program that goes along with the increased services to medical. So now all of a sudden you're providing a voucher to take the bus or take a cab or take something to that dental appointment that only has 4 parking spots that really needs 10. You know, we need to think outside the box. And the only reason why I mention this is because you're setting a new policy. And we need to address the bigger picture items when we're setting up even the newer, smaller policies. So that is my point around sensible transportation, and it's got to start here. It's got to start small, and it's got to start locally. And I think this is how you start to make an example of that or a statement towards that. And on the building practices is the second point. The San Lorenzo Valley is unique in its lots and its slopes and the habitat in which it surrounds it. It is different than downtown Watsonville or downtown Aptos, which also is governed by this board. So I just say be careful about the language and what is allowed, because it happens in the San Lorenzo Valley a lot, exactly what Kevin is talking about. You got a building that's in a footprint that has a screened-in porch that was built in 1940. That screened-in porch turns into an alternative bedroom that has a bathroom to it. You know, that happens. That happens every day. I see it every day. And those are the types of things that we really need to stop and really take a look at. Thank you.
Members of the commission, my name is Elia Balaj, and I'm a Watsonville resident. And I did address the commission on this item last September. One of the items that I discussed pertained to a provision to allow the reestablishment of a non-conforming use that has been discontinued for a prolonged period of time. I recommended a provision that would allow reestablishment of such a non-conforming use that exceeded the dormant time period of 3 years, subject to a public hearing and a use permit approval. The commission did support the recommendation, and staff subsequently presented that item to the board. I attended that board meeting. On this topic, Supervisor Neil Coonerty expressed misgivings about allowing a non-conforming use to return without time restrictions, use permit provisions notwithstanding. I did provide response input that time, but it should be noted that the board was only approving a procedure as opposed to a policy debate. Nonetheless, this topic is clearly somewhat of an unsettled issue. Your draft amendment before you does contain the use permit provision. However, I wanted to provide some observations to the commission to shed some light on this issue. A real-life file case example will illustrate my point that exists in Watsonville. At the intersection of Highway 2129, Riverside Drive, and Martian Street, this is a parcel that has residential zoning with several residential dwellings and a box-like commercial building. The commercial building has service doors, large plate glass windows, zero setback, no on-site parking. Given the residential zoning, that building is clearly a non-conforming structure, yet it is only viable for commercial use, which would be non-conforming. However, the building is in solid structural shape, quite usable. When constraints were put on the owner from reestablishing a discontinued non-conforming use, the owner balked at tearing the building down. The building went into limbo, could not be legally used for either residential or commercial uses. It became unused and dormant. The situation appeared to me to be stunted utilization of community resources. Eventually, the city relented and allowed the time constraints to be relaxed. But to put perspective, even now, there are newer conforming structures with conforming use zoning that have been sitting vacant in this county for more than 3 years. I believe that you have unusual non-conforming situations in every district in this county that would result in a functional, durable building going vacant and going into an intractable limbo if you do not have the option of a non-conforming use to be established there. Given that the issue has arisen, the Commission is within rights to ponder any pitfalls that might arise from allowing reestablishment. Yet, speaking from the public floor, I'm here to affirm the validity of the proposed policy and to request the Commission to retain it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next. Good morning. Ron Powers, land use consultant. Dee Murray and Marty Fiorovich were here this morning and heard the staff presentation. They both had appointments. They had to leave, so they asked me to pass on to the staff and the commission the support for this ordinance and for the ordinance changes before you. So they're very supportive of the progress that's been made on the draft ordinances. And also just to hopefully reiterate that they would like the opportunity to again to be part of the focus groups to work further to develop the administrative guidelines for the 75% threshold and the structural changes associated with that. So I did submit a letter, and I apologize it was late. I know that's frustrating when you get last minute correspondence like that, but I it's not that complicated. I think it may look more complicated than it is. My two or three points. I believe that it's appropriate to put the definitions relating to 1310 all under the 1310-700. There has been some effort in the past to consolidate the definitions in that section, and instead of having each individual section have their own set of ordinances or definitions, go ahead and consolidate those. So that's pretty straightforward. And Commissioner Dan mentioned one in her comments, one of my other points, and that relates to the findings both on page 17 and 20. Just in general terms, what I was really getting at there was just to ask the commission and the staff to take another look at those just to see if they really are adding any extra review or extra value in terms of a focus item, because I thought when you read through some of the existing findings that are already required to be made, you know, health, safety, welfare, general public, consistency with general plan, there's so much covered in those findings that they really can incorporate a broad topic. So that's my request, just to review the proposed findings. I thought there were some that were redundant. And the third item that I wanted to speak at, or I've been asked to speak at by some members of the Coastal Property Owners Association, relates back to the concept of the reconstruction after natural disaster. And I know we've kind of beat this one around several different ways and over the past few meetings. And what struck me, I think, and a couple of the members, when they asked me to look at this and see if there's anything they could come up with, their perspective is from today, before a disaster, they're looking for some level of certainty on their own specific property. And so the only thing I could think of, because you have to have the geologic exception in there, that's obvious. You have to have the right-of-way exception that's over the property line. You want to have the opportunity to review those individually, but I think there may be, and maybe there's a mechanism that I'm throwing this out because I haven't thought it through, but for staff and the department to offer some kind of pre-review for real estate professionals or people, owners that really want to have that certainty, have somebody go out and look at it and say, yeah, you know what, you're in your situation, we would allow a reconstruction here. It's not that big of a deal. And here's your certificate or whatever, your letter that says, yes, in the event of a natural disaster, you would be allowed to reconstruct your non-conforming structure. I don't know. That's just one idea. But that's really the point, is that the owners have been concerned about. You know, they've been focused on, it's like, well, yeah, we read the ordinance, but where's the certainty? We don't really understand how that relates to their own situation. So maybe there's a future way to resolve that. And the last item that's not part of the letter, just, and Kathy may have mentioned this at some previous meetings, but we're introducing some new processes, administrative use permit, administrative site development permit, and I'm hoping that over time that we can eliminate or consolidate the types of permits, and maybe that's already the idea, but we've got commercial development permit, conditional use permit, administrative site development permit, residential development permit. It just gets a little confusing, and maybe that was part of your focus. So thank you.
Thank you. Any further speakers? Then seeing none, we'll close the public hearing and return it to the commission.
Sure.
Sure.
I just wanted to go back to what the previous speaker, Mr. Village, was talking about, which was the being able to start it in non-conforming use when a property has been vacant. And so I was reading that section that starts on page 14 at the bottom and goes on to page 15. And the way I understand it is that if that time has lapsed, the 3 years out of the five or 3 years after a catastrophic event, that there is still a mechanism to be able to go into a space with a non-conforming use. It just requires a level five review. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Yes, that's correct. And that's a new provision that's currently not provided in our code.
And that was included because of the public testimony that was provided by Mr. Village in the last meetings. And so you guys supported that idea, so that's why it's in there. And he was just confirming that it really is needed and it really does have it.
Yeah, and I welcome that point. Thank you.
I'd like to move the staff recommendation.
We have one additional thing we'd like to call your attention to. In the letter from Betty Cost, she wasn't able to testify today, but she very much supported the ordinance changes. She had a few questions, which I don't know that we need to go over here. We can talk with her separately. But she did have one suggestion that we think actually you might want to consider, which is the second paragraph to the end of her letter. There's a section related to structures that contain non-conforming uses. She thinks that conforming additions to a structure that contains a non-conforming use should be able to be reviewed at a level four rather than level five. And we've considered that, and we actually think that that's a good idea. You know, if it's a conforming addition, then the administrative site review rather than a public hearing in front of the zoning administrator would be fine. As with all permits, we always have the opportunity to elevate it, you know, by kick it up a level, if you will, if we feel that the particular situation warrants a higher level of review. So I think that where that change would occur is on page 16 of your original packet. It's on page 7 of the actual ordinance. So if you're on that page, then the first chart, modifications to a structure accommodating a non-conforming use, the third row would change the right-hand column of that third row would read like the row below it, the administrative use permit level 4 approval, rather than conditional use permit level 5 approval.
And that is appealable by the public, right? The level 4?
Level 4s are appealable.
That's why.
And I also have something to add, if you don't mind. It's been brought to my attention that there's another correction to make. It's on page 24 of the packet. A phrase was repeated twice, so it's a typographical error. But it's section 1310.323(e)(6)(b), talking about side and rear yard setbacks, and the second half of item I, that last sentence is repeated in item II, so it can be deleted from that first paragraph. So I would delete from that a detached accessory structure which is located entirely through the end of the period that closes the sentence.
That's also be a modification that I agree to.
I'm not sure we had a second. Did we have a second?
Second.
Oh, okay. So now we have a motion on the floor. Okay, is there anything further on this?
I just want to make a general comment here, Mr. Chairman. You know, every time I show up for a meeting, we have people that are proponents or opponents or maybe a few people that are curious about what's going on. But you know, we publish things that say in a newspaper of general circulation, which is getting more and more of diminished value. And I really want to commend the staff for putting the administrative guidelines online. The more we can do to disseminate this information, because there's just this huge gap in terms of the public's understanding what's going on. And it was driven home to me when I we went through an extensive renovation of our house, and my wife's a planner. But the permits, the interaction, whatever, it's really daunting. So my point is, whatever we can do to put more on the web and to have workshops, to work with some of the giveaway newspapers, the Aptos Times, whatever, I think it's really important to get this information in general circulation. Thank you.
I had just one question back to Mr. Powers' comment about the definition being consolidated in all one section. It seemed like there was an effort. He says that there, you know, this was discussed as far back as the mid-90s. Is there merit to that, or is there a reason why there should be kept separate, or what's the staff thinking on that?
Actually, what's happening is they appear in two places. They do appear in 1310.700. Same wording as proposed here. We're just proposing it live here as well, so that if somebody is looking just in that section, they don't have to be aware of going back to another section and looking for it. So it's a way to make it easier for people to find the definition they're looking for in that place, but it also appears in the consolidated place.
Okay. And the definitions are identical in both sections, so there's no conflict with the definitions.
So it's helpful.
And then I guess sort of a general question for the staff is, I understand that this is the latest step, or I don't know if it's the third or the final step in sort of an ongoing process to try and streamline and simplify the zoning regulations. But what comes, are there plans for further refinement? I mean, is there something afoot to continue this process, which I think is working pretty well?
It's going to be an ongoing process of going through the code, and where we find difficulties, really taking this time to look at them and address them. So there's not a specific program that has phases, but as we go through and as we hear from people about what is most difficult, we're going to look at those things and bring them to you as we can.
We are working on an update to ensure consistency with state Coastal Act and guidelines. So there's Chapter 1320, which is really how we administer and carry out the coastal permitting process. So we're working with coastal staff on an initial draft of that that we've prepared. We're also working toward, as Mr. Powers pointed out, gradually transitioning away from calling permits levels 1 through 7 and calling them what they actually are, whether it's a use permit or a site development permit. So we're working on that. So that's Chapter 1810. The big package that we'll be working on, but that you won't see for a while, is to update the use charts and development standards for commercial, industrial, residential, agricultural use, and so that's why this package is fairly broad, because the Board of Supervisors wanted us to address the nonconforming provisions and to develop a package of provisions that would facilitate change, commercial uses changing in and out of the buildings, and kind of support some level of easier business location, et cetera. So that this completes the things that the board had specifically requested. And then the other changes that are but will be more kind of comprehensive will be to fulfill just sort of the broader goal of modernizing, updating, and making the code easier to use. So, but that's going to, we're partway through that work, but that's going to take longer to prepare.
Well, I guess, in closing, I'll say that it's a tremendous work product. The staff really should be commended for it. I can't, in all my years of, working in the public sector, I can't recall ever seeing an ordinance that had 60-some-odd sections. I mean, this is really comprehensive, and it may seem difficult. I can appreciate some of the speakers who said it's difficult to, sort of unwind everything that's in here. But to me, it seems like it's seizing the moment and the time is right for this. And I think you've done a great job of hitting the sweet spot, I guess, on what need, on what I think are appropriate revisions to the county code. So I'm real happy with it. Time will tell, I guess, how it plays out. But I just sense that this is going to really make life a lot easier for a lot of property owners and architects and engineers and land use planners and staff. So it's a great job.
Just some general comments. I know lunchtime awaits, but I just wanted to again thank the staff. I thought this was a really great job and just a lot of good clarifications across the board. I was really happy to see the well, just a lot of stuff here. As I mentioned earlier, the parking spaces, I would like to still propose that a friendly amendment to Commissioner Aramburu's motion to change the medical facilities from 200 to 225. I personally, I agreed with a lot of Mr. Hammer's statements about long-term, the need for long-term activity towards garnering more alternative transportation methods. However, I think that allowing businesses to get their foot in the door, and even if they're afforded 3-4 extra spaces, if that's done in conjunction with some of these parking demand management, shared parking contracts, I think it'll make it more conducive for them to be able to start up. I also wanted to acknowledge the statements around the riparian corridor. If I'm to be facetious for a moment, I don't want to water down those riparian requirements. And just looking at the Pajaro River in particular, I'm not as familiar with the San Lorenzo River, but the agriculture oftentimes keeps encroaching closer and closer to those benches and making the gradient much more steep than it otherwise would be. And I could completely appreciate the need to preserve the waterways and make sure that all our watershed systems are taken care of as best as possible. I also really appreciated the ability for staff to at times defer to the planning director to make certain calls with situations in which there's some blurry, fuzzy
interpretations that could be had. It reminds me of, what is it, episode 4 of Star Wars, when Luke Skywalker is about to shoot the Death Star and he has it locked in, and Obi-Wan Kenobi appears and says, "Let the Force be with you," and he takes off the thing and shoots the Death Star down. I think sometimes that, I wish the Force is with you, Kathy, is what I'm saying. And then, of course, also the work around the non-conforming uses, as Mr. Bulaich has worked aggressively towards. I really have come to appreciate the need to preserve non-conforming structures and also those structures which accommodate non-conforming uses, just preserving those historical buildings, anything we can do to keep them in place. I think it contributes towards almost a polyphonic neighborhood of historical voices. And if, you know, we can in the future move towards preserving those buildings which someday will be considered historic, I really think that'll be a real long-lasting asset to the community. And again, I just wanted to thank staff for all their great work here.
Can I ask a question? If I think I hear you maybe proposing an amendment.
Yeah.
If would that require further? I hope it wouldn't. But I mean, if you went from 200 to 225, would that require further CEQA or environmental review that would delay this? Or
I think we actually did the CEQA review based on the 1 to 200 requirement, and it was only after CEQA that we sort of said, well, you know, maybe 1 for 225. Like I said, we kept going back and forth. So the CEQA document is already assumed 1 for 200.
Okay. So I guess it should be up to Mr. Render.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I sort of came to the same conclusion that, you know, this is sort of reopening it. And would it be possible, when it goes to the Board of Supervisors, to communicate to them that there was some interest in taking a look at that number?
Well, I don't think you know yet. I think you guys can decide whether
you want to accept the amendment.
Frankly, I would not support the amendment because it has gone through CEQA review in one way. Maybe Mr. Chellenden can chime in, but I'm really reluctant to do that. Just, you know, without discussing the merits, more from a procedural standpoint.
We did CEQA based on the proposed amendment, 1 for 200. But, I mean, I think that, so it CEQA wouldn't be the concern. It would be, you know, look at it from the perspective of what do you think is the appropriate parking spot.
So are you telling me that it'd be all right to accept the amendment, sort of post facto?
Well, it's not really post facto. You know, when the material went through the draft and the focus groups, it was always 1 for 200. When it went through CEQA, it was always 1 for 200. And we continued to have some discussion, you know, wanting to make sure that particularly in the medical dental context, there was adequate parking. And we're only talking about 25 square feet, you know, per a difference. So, yes, I think we, as staff, we could also live with the 1 per 200 rather than the 1 per 225.
Well, with some reluctance, I'll accept the amendment.
That's true.
Okay, so the amendment has been accepted. Is there any other discussion? Okay, so the motion then is to approve the staff recommendation with that one change and the other changes that you identified before the motion. So we don't need a roll call, do we? So okay, then all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, so that carries 4-0 with one absent. And congratulations. Mm-hmm. This goes to the Board of Supervisors next. And do you know when? Is there a date when it will go to the board?
We do have a tentative date in February. We were setting it today, so I think it's 3 weeks from yesterday.
28th. Probably February 28th.
Okay, so those who might be interested, you know, check the board agendas, but it sounds like next month it will be on a board agenda.
We'll also put that information on our website.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to commend staff on, you know, fabulous work that they worked really hard, did a lot of research, and the package, I think, really reflects, you know, all of that. It's, I think, excellent work, so I wanted to thank staff for that.
Okay, so with that, we're at the end of the agenda, and I guess the meeting will be adjourned.